when the Retosaurus is rampaging through the city. At one point, the army's like, we don't know where it is. I'm like, how? Why?
Yeah. Listen to like huge thunderous footsteps and you'll probably be able to find it, you know?
Follow the screams. It's New York
Yeah,
City.
that too. Yeah. The burning buildings, the smoke rising into the air. It's not very stealthy. It shouldn't be that hard.
Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Podcast. We are your hosts, Vincent Hannum.
And Matt Levine.
And we're talking about all our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time.
Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts welcome here.
And Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Link in the show notes.
I say there are things better left unsolved.
Who knows what waits for us in nature's no man's land?
Impossible, unbelievable, fantastic. But I tell you, it could happen. It could happen. It could happen. It could happen.
Yes, it could happen. For various authorities believe that buried somewhere under the polar ice cap, in a state of suspended animation, are the awesome creatures, the leviathans that roamed the earth at the dawn of time. And under certain conditions, a nuclear explosion could free one from his icy tomb. Then, guided by instinct, the beast would come back to the caverns of the deepest Atlantic where it was spawned. An armored giant, wreaking his prehistoric fury on modern man and his puny machines. Cities would be terrorized by the cruel intruder from the past. Populations crazed and panicked with fear by its destructive force. Granite and steel would crumble. Soldiers and their weapons would be powerless before the onslaught of the beast. The beast. The beast. The beast from 20,000 fathoms.
Herald Square, 34th Street. Broadway. Every section of the city is guarded. No one knows where the monster will strike next.
Another one, Colonel?
No.
You know what a radioactive isotope is?
No, but if it can be loaded, I can fire it.
I'll load it. Just remember one thing. This is the only isotope of its kind this side of Oak Ridge, so you can't miss.
Matt, it is season 5 of Camp Kaiju. We're here. This is our season premiere, debuting with The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms.
Hooray! An auspicious start, both to 2025 and to season 5 of Camp Kaiju.
Yeah, I mean, I know we caught up a little bit off camera here, but obviously we just talked about Nosferatu, but any other movies to highlight your new year?
Oh, let's see. Not really a lot of monster movies, to be honest. I did watch Smile 2, which was a little bit disappointing. I like the first Smile quite a bit. The second one, maybe not so much. I do want to call out the best movie by far I've seen recently, which is called West Indies, The Fugitive Slaves of Liberty. It's by a Mauritanian director named Med Hondo. I'm really into African movies from the 60s and 70s, like post-colonial, post-independence. And this movie is incredible. It's beautiful. It basically tells the entire 400-year history of the transatlantic slave trade. And it all is shot on a replica of a slave ship in an abandoned factory in France is where they shot the movie. So I don't know if that description makes any sense. It's a crazy movie. that's my recommendation. West Indies. Go see it.
Amazing. Wow. I feel like a schlub. What have I seen? I saw a really bad but lovable Boris Karloff movie called The Ape recently. A Poverty Row movie, which Mr. Laurie will have something to say about later in this episode.
Nice.
Definitely not a critical darling, but a campy romp nonetheless.
I've heard of that. I, you know, by its title only, I assume it's part of the sort of like Deadly Monkey series of movies that came out maybe in like the 30s and 40s.
Yep. Stars a man in a gorilla suit, a very convincing gorilla suit. Nonetheless. Yeah. So I'm just really digging into some trash horror from the studio era.
Yeah, I love it. I've definitely seen some trash recently, too. But, you know, a good movie here and there as well. And trash is good in its own way, too.
Yeah, I say that lovingly.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, not too many other newer movies. I did see Baby Girl, which I thought was pretty good. We talked about Nosferatu. Yeah, so that's kind of all I got right now, I guess.
Yeah. Well, we are just getting started with the year with our to-watch lists, and we want to thank you all, you listeners and friends, for hanging out with us. Please rate and review wherever you listen. You can send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com, our Instagram at camp_kaiju, or if you'd like to be a featured voice on the show, leave a voicemail at 612-470-2612 and just tell us about your favorite monster movies and memories. Go ahead and check out our website, campkaijupodcast.com, for more reviews and special content. We have merch available at campkaiju.threadless.com. Become a patron for exclusive content, discounts, priority comments, and live events, some VIP status. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. And all those links are in our show notes. And we can't wait to bring you on board this wonderfully kooky ride called Monster Movies. That's what it's called. It's called the Monster Movie Ride.
It is indeed. Yeah, I love that. And the further we ride on this train of monster movies, the more I realize that it's inexhaustible. There will never be enough monster movies to like watch all of them that have ever been made. And that is a wonderful thing.
Oh, my God. I feel the exact same way. My list, I keep a running list of movies I want to bring to the podcast. And it's just, I'm never going to talk about them all.
Yeah, it's a wonderful problem to have. Like when we were figuring out movies to bring to the podcast for season 5, initially I was worried like, man, am I even going to be able to think of enough for this season? And of course, the problem is the opposite. I came up with a list of like 30 movies that could last us for years, you know?
And The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms and even Dracula's Daughter, which you're going to bring later on, those are both movies I covered way back in season 1 when I was flying solo. But not only is the list of new movies inexhaustible, but I have to revisit the movies I talked about in that first season because I really only gave them lip service. And The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms is a movie I really wanted to dig deeper into with you and get your perspective on it. So we're drowning here.
In the best way possible. Yeah. I love revisiting movies. Oftentimes I think you discover new things or maybe even like completely change your opinion about them. So new rewatch movies, whatever it is, we have plenty to choose from here on Camp Kaiju.
Oh yeah. And let us get to some news I need to cover. We took a little extended break over the holidays. Much needed reset for me personally, because we were going pretty hard there at the end of the year.
Yeah.
So
indeed. Yeah, it was like exhausting in the best way. I mean, like talking about monster movies, like researching monster movies, watching monster movies. It was like a full-time job. It was great.
I know. If only we were getting paid. But, yeah. You know, the Patreon is a great source if you are willing to patronize. No, that's not the word. Patronage, to patron, be a patron, and support the show financially. It really does help with the back end and allow us to offer some VIP perks. And here's where I'm going to get into some news. So Naomi Osborne, friend of the pod, she is hosting her monthly trivia show at Indeed Brewery in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And Naomi's bringing on guest trivia hosts each month. And we are honored to be on the slate for May. So the first Monday in May, Cinco de Mayo, Matt, you and I will be co-hosting trivia, movie trivia with Naomi.
Yes, I can't wait. It was so fun doing trivia with her on the podcast last season. And, you know, both of us went to her trivia show at Indeed Brewery, and it's so much fun. I mean, obviously, if you love movies and you love trivia, it's the best place to be. And I'm very, very excited to join her in May and join you in May. It'll be great.
It's going to be a May to remember. And maybe you won't remember it because Camp Kaiju, I'm saying it right now, we are going to offer our patrons. I know not all of you are located in the Twin Cities, but if you are or not, if you show up to trivia, we will buy you a drink. One drink, alcoholic or non-alcoholic, it's on us. So we'd love to see you and play some movie trivia.
And hopefully just talk about movies a little bit too.
Yeah.
Man, it'll be fun. I can't wait.
Yeah. And a couple other things, just I'm going to throw it out there real quickly. If you are interested in joining the Camp Kaiju team in a more professional way, we are looking for writers to contribute to our website and the written word. Obviously, opportunities exist to come on the podcast with us, but if you are a writer and like to review movies, shoot us an email. Let's talk and get you set up with something. You would be compensated. I'm not going to say it's much, but we value that here. We value the artistic professional spirit.
Indeed, you'll be compensated perhaps in cheap monster movie DVDs, but also monetarily. So, you know, many, many different ways you'll be compensated. And just to verify, the email address that they should email if they're interested is campkaiju@gmail.com.
Correct.
Awesome. I'm excited. Can't wait to see, you know, get some new voices on the website.
Yeah, I think that'd be great. Fresh perspectives. Like we're saying, it's always important. Well, making it all happen is our patrons, Jason, Chris, Sean, our anonymous patron, and Peggy. Thank you. Let's get some other folks in your ranks. All right. Since last time, Matt, I threw a couple of notes on there. Feel free to read those and add a couple things if you want, but I thought they were interesting.
Yeah, so the 2024 National Film Registry added Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and Invaders from Mars to their list of, you know, culturally significant films, which I didn't know about until I read this on our shared doc for today. Two good choices, for sure. I think we're talking about Invaders from Mars soon, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. That's why it caught my eye, because it just so happened that we were talking about it. And lots of other movies were obviously added, but I picked a couple of my favorite sci-fi movies that I saw on the list.
I haven't seen Wrath of Khan since I was a kid. It's a good reminder. I should revisit the Star Trek movies at some point.
It's been years, but yeah, it's good. It's so much fun.
Yeah, classic. Those movies are extremely entertaining from what I remember.
Yeah, very. They just scratch that sci-fi itch of adventure, but like science and Shatner and Nimoy and the whole gang.
Yeah, the OG cast. Yeah,
I know. Yeah,
or well,
yeah,
yeah. No, sorry. Never mind.
Okay.
I was going to say, actually, that's not the OG cast, but it is. I got confused for a second. Never mind. Mm-hmm. I'll take it back.
The last bit there, it's been recently announced that Universal is in talks with Lee Cronin, who directed Evil Dead Rise, to some acclaim, to revamp The Mummy.
I don't mind another Mummy movie. I didn't really like Evil Dead Rise very much. And I have to admit, I don't really know Lee Cronin all that much. What else? Evil Dead Rise, what else did he do? Yeah, I'm not really familiar with his work. But, you know, I love a good Mummy movie. So we'll see. Maybe it'll be good. The last one with Tom Cruise, I know, was supposed to be terrible, but I never actually saw that one.
Yeah. Well, I hope it's good. I hope it's out there in a few years and they're not just teasing us like they so often do.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, the Brendan Fraser series is not like, maybe those might not be like masterpieces, but that's such a fun series. It would be hard to top them, but certainly possible. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Let us get to this week in monster movie history. There's a lot. There's a lot in January. Well, we'll say this month in monster movie history.
Yeah. I feel like this is the time of year that studios like release their movies that they think are terrible and nobody wants to see. So maybe that's not super surprising.
Well, that's a contemporary thing, I think, because there are some true classics on this list from back in the day.
That's true. Yeah.
Relic? You're telling me The Relic is garbage? Relegated to the January slums?
Well, I mean, I like The Relic, but I'm also not totally surprised that the studio was just like, who cares about this movie? Get it out there in January. That's not all that surprising to me. But you're right. There's some good stuff on this list and some truly terrible stuff as well. Well, I think I'm going to have to start with maybe my least favorite movie of all time. I'm sure you saw this on the list. Leprechaun from 1993. I really hate that movie so much. And like, normally I like so bad it's good movies. Like, I love Troll 2. I really like The Room a lot, Plan 9 from Outer Space, and so on and so forth. But Leprechaun is just boring. It's not funny or scary. Some of the sequels in that franchise are, but the first one is not. And I remember seeing Leprechaun and just thinking like, well, this is what I get for thinking like this stupid movie about a killer leprechaun would be like somehow entertaining. I feel like I got what I deserved on that one.
You know who played a leprechaun in The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms? Sorry, he did not play a leprechaun in The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms.
Okay.
You missed the leprechaun, didn't you?
Yeah. Did I watch the abridged version?
No, Cecil Kellaway, who plays the elderly doctor, scientist, he was nominated for an Oscar for playing a leprechaun in The Luck of the Irish from the 40s.
Okay. I'm not familiar with that movie.
Yeah.
I could definitely see him playing a leprechaun, though.
Let's see. For my pick for this episode, I'm going to go with The Island of Lost Souls. We are talking about the 90s Island of Dr. Moreau later in our season. I think it's going to be really hard to top Island of Lost Souls, the 1933 adaptation of H.G. Wells's pretty messed up story. I'm reading the book right now, and it's sci-fi, but it's got a horror bent to it for sure. Island of Lost Souls. Check it out, people.
I'm glad you chose an actual great movie there, because that is fantastic. It's still pretty scary and very perverse, kind of like you're alluding to with the book. The movie, it's like a pre-code movie, so there's a lot of sex and violence that they wouldn't have been able to get away with just a couple years later. So that is a fantastic movie for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Ooh, okay. Lee Whannell's Wolfman is coming out in January. It's a January horror movie, so we'll see.
I'm excited for that one.
Yeah. And then coming up on Camp Kaiju, your pick.
Yeah, Invasion of Astro Monster. So we'll be getting back to a good old Ishiro Honda Godzilla movie, the sixth film in the Godzilla franchise. I don't really know a lot about it, to be honest, but it like the screenshots that I've seen just look so fantastic and like bright and colorful. Was it the first color Godzilla movie? Maybe not the first one, but...
No, not the first.
Relatively early, though.
Yeah. You know who is in it, though?
Nick Adams.
Nick Adams.
we've seen him before. He was also in Godzilla versus King Kong, right?
He was in Ghidorah, the three-headed monster.
Okay, that's right. I know we've seen him before.
Yeah.
I mean, I love Ghidorah.
No, sorry. He was in Frankenstein Conquers the World. That's what he was in.
Yeah, okay. I'm seeing that now. All right.
Mm-hmm. Remember that one scene where he's decked out in like red, white, and blue barbecue aprons and chef hats?
Sort of.
Like cooking a steak.
Yeah, kind of. That's a really bizarre movie. There's so much weird stuff. It just kind of all maybe blurs together a little bit. Yeah. I should rewatch that.
I'm a big Nick Adams fan, so I can't wait. I'm so excited you picked that movie.
Yeah, and I think maybe we've talked about almost every other Godzilla movie that came out before that one, because Invasion of Astro Monsters from 65.
I think
might be
so.
One or two, but yeah, so it's good to go back to some of the original classics.
Mm-hmm. And then we're going to talk about Tusk from 2014. Who directed that? It was
Kevin Smith.
Kevin Smith, that's right. I don't know what to expect of that movie. I'm mentally preparing myself for some weird body horror.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Likewise. I've never seen it, but even when it came out like 10 years ago, I was like, this sounds so bizarre. I need to see this. And then I just never have. So yeah. I'm really excited. We'll be talking about it soon.
It's about a podcaster.
Yeah. A podcaster who is maybe a little too obsessed with walruses, right? As far as I know. Or, well, he's the victim of that, I guess. But we won't provide any more.
I don't know. Is he the victim of a heinous walrus act?
From what I've read, but, we'll have to see. We'll have to find out soon.
Okay.
I know the plot is something like that. It's so strange. Yeah.
All right. The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Bit of a tongue twister. But what's your personal history with this film?
This was my first time watching it, and I had wanted to see it for so long. I knew that it was very influential in the monster movie subgenre. Was a huge influence on Godzilla and some other movies. I won't get ahead of ourselves too much, but I've heard a lot about this movie, and I've always been very excited to see it, but I haven't until now.
All right. This was my second watch. I first watched it just a few years ago, and Ye Old Video Universe, the video rental store that shut down a couple years ago here, I picked up the DVD for $5. Can't really see it, but no. On this DVD, there are some really great featurettes that I found on YouTube, of course, and I've linked those in our show notes, and I would highly recommend those to anyone wishing to learn more, because most of my notes are going to come from those featurettes and a couple of their other readings that I've sourced in the link in the show notes.
And with Ray Harryhausen and Ray Bradbury both being involved with this movie, I just think there's a lot more sort of like firsthand accounts than you might get with a lot of these older monster movies. So there's a wealth of information out there about this movie.
Yeah. So we'll go through that, folks. We'll go through the cast and crew. We'll go through that production history. We'll go through its release and the legacy of this film. We will hear from Peter Lorre. He's going to premiere his Poverty Row picture show tonight for you. He's going to talk about The Boys of the City, a monogram picture from 1940. Trust me, it's a little more exciting than that title would have you believe. And then we'll give the Beast our final rating, and we'll peace out until Godzilla. In a couple weeks.
Yeah.
Most terrifying news of all. At nightfall, monstrous animals crawl out of crater of volcano. Great herds of cattle stampede before this living inferno. Vast area devastated by appalling new horror. A creature named the Black Scorpion by panic-stricken people of San Lorenzo. Entire population prays for deliverance.
For miles around, cowboys came upon one dead steer after another. One of them had heard the tale of the demon bull of the Maricopa. Having lost family or friends, something absolutely unknown, he could be in another world.
Nation's leaders confer as news received a possible threat to capital.
This is a city of 4 million people. If word of these leaks out, the panic of the population could be worse than the scorpions.
The Black Scorpion destroys communications. Hundreds annihilated.
The kind of movie you're waiting to see as John Ford and Marion C. Cooper present Mighty Joe Young, whose sensational exploits will startle you, thrill you, electrify you with hair-raising excitement and suspense. See Mighty Joe Young as he savagely resists capture in his native Africa.
Joe! Joe!
See the most fantastic relationship between beast and beauty, a mere girl mastering a primitive giant. See Mighty Joe Young, enraged by Hollywood pranksters, destroy Filmland's swankiest nightclub on a fabulous Sunset Strip.
Mighty Joe Young.
The picture that's alive with the most sensational action thrills ever filmed.
Mightier than King Kong, Mighty Joe Young.
Picture of our time has ever unleashed shock spectacle of such scope and realism as up from the depths of prehistoric mystery rages Virgo. The headlines of the world blaze the fabulous story of this monster from another age, catapulted from some vast sub-ocean cavern by unprecedented volcanic action. And the headlines scream the story of the reckless skin divers who captured the monster and put it on exhibition.
Stop! Pull out!
Drop the net!
What do you think you're doing? Hey, take it easy.
I came to let him go back to the sea where he belongs.
Why?
Maybe to save your silly skins for you.
Hurry, hurry, hurry to see Gogo!
But the headlines do not record the story of a little boy who had a curious sympathy and understanding for the fantastic creature. What strange secret does he know that scientists only suspect?
You trying to say there may be a fully grown one of these things around somewhere? How big would a full grown one be?
An approximate guess. The infant? The adult.
That would make it nearly 200 feet tall.
Wreaking terrible vengeance against the civilization that has captured its offspring. Towering over the cities of the world as millions flee its awesome terror.
Matt, I know you want to talk about Eugene Laurier.
I do, yeah. Eugene Laurier, he was a Russian-French filmmaker. He started off as a production designer, working with Jean Renoir quite a bit. He did the production design on Grand Illusion from 1937, an all-time classic. Great movie. The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms was Laurier's directorial debut. Afterwards, he was kind of pigeonholed as a sci-fi director. He made The Colossus of New York from 1958, The Giant Behemoth from 1959, and a movie that we've talked about on the podcast, which I liked quite a bit, Gorgo from 1961.
I know, and I totally forgot Laurier directed that.
Me too. I recognized his name, but I couldn't place it at first. And then I did more research and saw that film in his filmography. And yeah, that's a good movie. It's kind of a British ripoff of both King Kong and Godzilla, but in the best way possible.
I know, but... Here we are talking about it again, and going back to our conversation on our never-ending list, The Giant Behemoth is a British monster movie, exactly what you'd expect. A giant dinosaur comes up from the ocean and destroys London in this case, or some city in England. With that said, though, I think it's really well done, and because it's British, that's been on my list for a long time.
Ooh, well, I think and I hope we'll talk about it someday. kind of makes me want to rewatch Gorgo again too, to be honest.
I know.
I remember we were, you know, not to spend too much time on this, but I remember when we talked about Gorgo, you brought up the friendship between the two men in that movie and how sort of like unexpectedly intimate it is. And like, maybe the question of if there's anything more than just platonic friendship going on, but regardless, it like their friendship is one of the most fascinating things about that movie, which is like more than just a ripoff. It's a little bit weirder than you would expect. So highly recommended, Gorgo.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So going back to The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, then this movie was produced by two guys, Jack Dietz and Hal E. Chester. Now, it's just too good. It's too good. This is all lining up with our Poverty Row series because Jack Dietz worked for Monogram Pictures in the 40s. He produced things like The Ape Man with Bela Lugosi. And Hal E. Chester was an actor in the troupe of young kids called the Bowery Boys or the East End Kids or the Dead End Kids. They were like the Little Rascals in the 30s and 40s. And they star in Boys of the City, which Mr. Lorre's talking about tonight. And I was like, Hal E. Chester is in that movie as an actor.
Wow. It all comes together. That's amazing.
Yeah, 10 years later, he produces this classic monster movie.
does Peter Lorre know that? I would imagine he does.
Yeah, I think he's the one who told me, actually.
Okay, nice. Yeah. He knows his stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's like he was there.
Right, yeah. Well, that's amazing. What a cool coincidence. That's great.
Yeah. Okay. The screenplay is by Lou Morheim and Fred Freiberger. Friedberger? It's a fun name. The story itself, though, was suggested by Ray Bradbury's own short story called The Foghorn, published in 1951 in the Saturday Evening Post. We're going to talk a lot about that story and Bradbury's connection after we get through the cast and crew here.
Indeed. And so those were the credited screenwriters and story developers, but there were actually others that I think worked on the screenplay uncredited. I think actually Harryhausen and the director Eugene Lorre did a little bit. Robert Smith, I read, also contributed to the screenplay. To be honest, I don't know a lot about him, but as usual, this was kind of a screenplay by committee sort of situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Were you familiar with John L. Russell?
No.
He's a cinematographer for this movie, and he also did the photography for Psycho.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Now I feel uneducated. I feel like I should know that name. John L. Russell. Yeah. Huh. I absolutely should have known that he shot Psycho, which is, of course, an incredibly shot movie. Wow. I don't see a lot of other titles on his list that I recognize, but that's amazing. And, you know, one of the things I love about Psycho is that Hitchcock chose to use kind of like a TV production crew. So maybe that's why I don't know his name quite as much, but I probably should, because he does great work.
Yeah. And this is something I like about the movie a lot. It is, before I even knew that, I noticed the photography in Beast. I noticed the use of light and shadow and fire in this movie. Like, there's a lot of sharp contrasts. And then when I made the Psycho connection, I mean, that black and white photography is beautiful too.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So Beast from 20,000 Fathoms would have been 7 years before Psycho. But yeah, to your point, I think like you can see signs of like what he would bring to Psycho already in this movie. And I would just add to what you said that like the use of like set design and like lighting the set in a certain way so it looks realistic instead of, you know, stage bound or whatever, like including the Arctic sets at the beginning of the movie, they look great. They're like, there's this bright white light that's kind of like very foreboding and ominous. So yeah, just in a nutshell, I agree with you. A really beautifully shot movie.
Yeah. Where were we? Oh, my tab. I lost it. I found it.
It's a common problem with Camp Kaiju. I have dozens of tabs open right now. most importantly, one of the most important crew members on The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms is Ray Harryhausen, stop motion animator, a legend, of course, in the monster movie and sci-fi genres. This was actually his first solo credit as the lead sort of special effects designer. He had previously assisted Willis O'Brien on Mighty Joe Young. And Willis O'Brien, I'm sure we'll talk about this a little bit more as well, but he was kind of an idol, a hero to Ray Harryhausen, because Willis O'Brien did the effects for The Lost World from 1925, as well as King Kong. So, you know, Harryhausen had been Willis O'Brien's assistant on Mighty Joe Young. But again, Beast from 20,000 Fathoms was his first movie in full control over the technical effects.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And this movie was an independent production, actually. It was later bought up by Warner Brothers. Dietz and Chester sold it to Warner Brothers, and they ultimately distributed the film and made a killing, as we'll get to in our release section.
Indeed.
All right. That's behind the camera. Who's in front of the camera in this movie?
Not too many people that I know about. in the lead role, we have Paul Christian, who is a Swiss actor. I think his birth name was Paul Hubschmid, if I remember right. But he often went by the last name Christian in his American movies. Mm. So he plays the main character of Professor Tom Nesbitt.
I am Mrs. Nesbitt.
I was thinking that as well. Such a great last name. I love it.
Paula Raymond plays Lee Hunter, the female scientist and eventual love interest of Mr. Nesbitt.
Then we also have Cecil Calloway, maybe Cecil Calloway. Sorry, I might be mispronouncing that. Who, according to Vincent, played a leprechaun in The Luck of the Irish, which I can verify now looking at his Wikipedia page. Cecil or Cecil Calloway was a South African character actor. He was also in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. The Postman Always Rings Twice. He was in that as well.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, he's another guy where I knew I recognized his face when I saw him in this movie. So he's kind of like the, you know, respected kind of old fuddy-duddy scientist who initially does not believe Professor Nesbitt, that he saw, you know, a dinosaur resurrected in the Arctic, but then comes around to believe him.
Yeah. Speaking of the Arctic, Kenneth Toby is in The Beast. He plays Colonel Jack Evans, and he played a prominent role in The Thing from Another World just a few years prior. So he was a familiar face that I like to see. Mm-hmm. And then this is where I'm uneducated. Lee Van Cleef is in this movie, and I knew I recognized that name, and he stars in Sergio Leone's Dollar Trilogy, which I've never seen.
Oh, I love those movies. I really love spaghetti westerns a lot. That's one of my favorite subgenres. And Lee Van Cleef is a fascinating person and actor. He, you know, this was in his early Hollywood career, and then he kind of got a little washed up in the late 50s. He, you know, unfortunately struggled with alcoholism and some other issues. He was deemed untrustworthy and didn't have any starring roles or even any supporting roles for quite a while until Sergio Leone reached out to him kind of at his lowest depths and wanted him to be in, I think, For a Few Dollars More was the first one that he was in that trilogy, although I could be wrong about that. But yeah, Lee Van Cleef has this tremendous, like, physicality. He looks kind of ominous but also weirdly beautiful at the same time, with like very sharp cheekbones, and like he's just a fascinating person. And even though he's only in this movie for like 5 minutes, maybe a little bit more, he makes an impact for sure.
Wow. Yeah, so I literally have those DVDs, like the trilogy, on my movie shelf, and I always look at them and say I need to watch them, and I just haven't yet.
They're great. I mean, Sergio Leone made some of the most stylish movies ever. They're beautiful, very entertaining. I think you're going to like them.
Oh, yeah. I have no doubt.
They're also great dad movies, so it's about time you watch them.
Yeah. I'm always looking for a good dad movie.
Yeah.
I forget what I watched recently. If it comes to me, I'll bring it up for sure.
Good. Yeah. You'll be an expert soon.
So this all started, The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, with a short story by none other than Ray Bradbury, who is a legendary science fiction writer Fahrenheit 451, The Martian Chronicles. Yeah, and we could go on and on. Mm-hmm. Well, in 1951, he was just starting his career. He was early, just like Ray Harryhausen, and he published a short story called, at the time, it was called The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms in the Saturday Evening Post. Now, it gets a little convoluted. Dietz and Chester, they're looking to produce a monster movie because King Kong had been re-released in 1951, 1952. So they wanted to produce their own version. They write this story called The Monster from Beneath the Sea. They bring Ray Harryhausen on board, say, we'd love you to do the special effects because we can't hire Willis O'Brien because our budget is next to nothing. We know you're going to work for free. So
pretty much, yeah.
Harryhausen, Dietz, and Chester, they're working on this movie. They bring in Ray Bradbury to just read the script because Harryhausen and Bradbury, I didn't know this, had been best friends since they were 18 years old. They met in LA, and over lunch, they were at a cafeteria, and they realized they both loved the movie The Lost World and King Kong. And hearing them talk in this interview, this featurette, one of them said, I think it's Bradbury, he's like, we became friends because we both liked dinosaurs.
I love that. That's such a childlike but not childish thing, you know? It's great.
Yeah, it's so wholesome.
Yeah. They're, again, I don't mean to steal your thunder, but in that same interview, one of them says something, I think, again, it's Bradbury, but he says, like, it's been, like, a pleasure growing old with Ray Harryhausen, but, like, staying young, you know? Like, not, yeah. Like, retaining that sort of childlike wonder. I love that. Yeah.
It's really great. It really inspired me. And I honestly didn't know anything about Ray Bradbury other than what I've read. Mm-hmm. So just to hear him talk was a treat. And yeah, knowing he and Ray Harryhausen were literally best friends. They weren't just like, oh yeah, we've known each other for decades. They were best men at each other's weddings. They've always been there for each other.
I love it. It's a heartwarming story. It's great. And the fact that they kind of reunited to make this movie, it just feels like fate was involved a little bit.
Yeah. It's the only time they actually worked together, unfortunately. But anyways, what happens is Harryhausen brings Bradbury in to read the script. And Bradbury says, you know what? This bears an awful lot of resemblance to my short story. Which it did, because Harryhausen had been shown an illustration from Bradbury's story. The only similarity is that they share is the lighthouse scene. But it was enough of a similarity where Dietz went, okay, you know what? Let's just buy the rights to your story, and we'll give you a credit. Bradbury will give you a credit, and because now you're a popular writer, so that gave some credit to the overall picture. So that's how it happened.
And they took the title of the story as well. They changed it to The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms.
Right. And then Bradbury changed the name of his story to The Foghorn. So that's the title you'll find his story under.
It is a little convoluted. I would love to read that story. I mean, the lighthouse attack scene in Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, maybe the best scene in the movie. And that's the one that's taken from the story. I don't know. Faithfully.
The story's like 6 pages long. I found it for free, just a PDF. But what it comes down to is there's a dinosaur that comes up from the sea, and it hears this foghorn, and the dinosaur thinks it's the call of a mate, of like a long lost companion, and it follows the foghorn until it finds the lighthouse. And then it's so heartbroken that it's not another dinosaur that it destroys the building.
It's a melancholy story.
Yeah. Which I'm just going to say, foreshadowing a little bit, I feel like the movie could have used more of that melancholy.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. Yeah, like we... you know, I mean, the beast in this movie is very intense, very frightening in a lot of different ways. But yeah, we don't get a sense of like, it maybe sounds weird to say his humanity, but it's kind of true. Like Godzilla and King Kong both have a human element to them, you know?
Exactly. Which is why I think ultimately those two movies, that's why they stand the test of time, and Beast might fall a little short of their status.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. But yeah. I suppose we're getting a little ahead of ourselves. I do still love the lighthouse scene in this movie. Mm-hmm. And I mean, probably people listening can't see the background behind you, but it's just very, it's a very beautiful scene. It's shot mostly in silhouette. Yeah. It's very haunting for sure.
It's striking. Yeah, yeah, I love it. So back to the production. And Matt, feel free to steal my thunder. I have no thunder to steal. Take it all. But there was a made-up dinosaur for this movie. It's called the Redosaurus. And that was because Ray Harryhausen, as he says, he didn't want to just create another like T-Rex type of thing or a Brontosaurus thing, because that had been done to death in the Willis O'Brien movies we keep mentioning. Mm-hmm. So he came up with his own concept, his own creature called the Redosaurus, a four-legged, it looks like a Tyrannosaurus mixed with an iguana maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where we get that.
Yeah, from what I read, it went through a lot of different designs, kind of started off with like a more round circular head until it kind of has this honestly fairly Godzilla-esque head that we see in the movie. Mm-hmm. I also read that like when this movie came out, it got some criticism from like paleontologists and scientists that it wasn't a realistic dinosaur. I was like, don't see a movie called The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms if you're looking for realism. That's probably not a good idea.
Seriously.
But no, I think the Redosaurus looks pretty good in this movie.
Yeah, I do too. It is fearsome. I do think, like, it's not scary, right? Like, this isn't scary to modern audiences, but I do think there's a ferocity to this creature that does make me go, oh, I wouldn't want to mess with this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are a couple point of view shots of people looking at the monster, like especially through windows, like that happens in the lighthouse scene. And it happens in an earlier scene where a couple fishermen on a boat look outside the windows and see the monster right outside of the window. And I would say those shots are actually sort of scary. Like we mm-hmm. see this like full on close up of the monster's head, and there's like, you know, rain and darkness and shadow in front of it. Like some really effective shots for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. We got to talk about Dynamation a little bit. This was Ray Harryhausen's trademark process of creating his visual effects. It's a matte process, to put it as simply as possible. Matt, would you like to read his quote? I think he explains it a little bit in his own words.
Yeah, definitely. I find this quote fascinating. So Harryhausen says, "I split the screen in front of the 16mm camera by using a glass with blacked out portions where the model was standing. After photographing one portion, I would rewind to the exposed film, black out the already exposed half, and then photograph the blacked out portion of the projection plate. Theoretically, the whole thing would look like the model was part of the picture." That's the end of his quote. And that technique had sort of been used for a while. Like whenever there are sort of like background matte paintings that are like in like, you know, the actors seem to be engaging with in some way, that's essentially a similar thing. But I think for stop motion animation, it had never been done like this, or never to this extent anyway. It's a very convincing effect in this movie.
Yep. Yep. And I'm still not an expert in describing it, but I know like if Willis O'Brien were to do this, he would have a whole team working with the sets, the model sets and the plates and the armatures. But Ray Harryhausen, he worked by himself. He preferred that. So his Dynamation could be done just by one person. That's one contrast.
Yeah.
But again, I think I need to like just have somebody actually show me physically in a room how this is done.
I know what you mean. I feel like I understand the broad concept. I don't totally understand how Dynamation is different than the other kinds of double exposure or whatever that had been done before. But all I know is it looks great in The Beast from 2000 Fathoms.
Yeah. And Harry hasn't worked for 5 to 6 months on these effects, and he put his own money into it at the end. He only had like $15,000 to work with, which is like, even at the time, it was next to nothing.
Yeah, and it's incredible that he did all the effects work himself. I'm sure we'll talk more about it later, but it's a labor of love. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That's why these movies, like the labor costs and the time costs of this kind of stop motion does take 5 to 6 months plus, which is why it's not really done. Even back in the day, folks, Ray Harryhausen was the only one really doing it to this level, because it was such a hard technique to do well. And you know it's bad when it's, you see a, yeah, you know bad stop motion when you see it.
Yeah. Like the Valley of Guanji, maybe. Am I right?
What?
I think maybe you like that movie a little bit more than I did. But I do think there's a vast disparity in quality for the stop motion animation between this movie and that one.
Yeah.
Although, was that Harryhausen too? Now I can't remember.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. I still feel like the Beast is better in its stop motion animation, but I take it back a little bit.
I think Beast is shot better.
Yeah.
Which I think has an effect on the overall impact.
Yeah, that's a good point. Maybe it's the other crew members and the cinematographer and whatnot who elevate it in this case.
Yeah.
And Harryhausen, of course, too, but the other crew members as well.
Because like you're talking about this lighthouse scene, it's shot so starkly black and white. In part because Harryhausen said it's just easier to hide the flaws of the animation.
Yeah, and I'm not a big fan of the Valley of Guanji's color cinematography, so...
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a good point. Yep. You've convinced
me. Sorry, I didn't mean to get a little defensive there.
No, you have convinced me. I think I'm being a little too hard on that movie. But The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms is way better.
I agree wholeheartedly. We're gonna fight here.
Yeah, I could tell I hit a nerve there. Sorry about that. I'm just kidding.
I'll cool it. Do you want to talk about the release and legacy?
Sure. Yeah, this was a huge box office hit. I think I read somewhere that Warner Brothers paid like $400,000 for it and then made millions like almost immediately. It did get mixed reviews. Critics were, you know, a little bit torn. They did generally praise the special effects of the monster, but complained a little bit about some of the human characters and maybe it dragged a little bit, some of the lack of realism, which again, I'm like, you're watching the wrong movie if that's what you're looking for, but it did get some mixed reviews. But the legacy of this movie was enormous. Vincent, like you said before, this came out shortly after a re-release of King Kong, I think in 1952. So those two movies together, King Kong and The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, those two are credited with kicking off the giant monster movie genre of the 1950s. Many of its plot devices would reappear very often throughout monster movies over the years. You have an ancient dinosaur being awoken from an atomic bomb. You know, you have all these scientists, like one of whom usually is like convinced of what's going on, and then many others who think he's kind of crazy. You generally have kind of like a maybe not super interesting love interest. so yeah, all those things are present in this movie for sure. All of those also would be influences on the following year's Gojira, or Godzilla, of course. Beast in 20,000 Fathoms is commonly seen as one of the direct influences on that movie. And, you know, indirectly, the whole Godzilla franchise.
Yeah, it was never like Tomoyuki Tanaka, the producer of Godzilla. He never admitted to that. But you read any source on the subject and you just watch the two movies and you're like, how could. Yeah, the Japanese producers were not living in a bubble. They saw this. They saw how successful it would be. They took it and they did their own thing with it. It's the beginning. It's the beginning of an entire genre starts here.
Yeah. And I think it's fascinating, you know, like maybe the first gasp of that was, you know, the Willis O'Brien movies that we already talked about, The Lost World and King Kong and some of those other sort of silent era or early sound like fantasy and monster movies. But then there was a gap of like maybe 20 years when, like, you know, monster movies weren't that huge. And then they came back in full force in the 1950s.
Yeah. Oh, it makes me think about, like, the cultural goo that was just simmering and the effect World War II had. I mean, I have read books on the subject of, like, why horror tastes, well, kind of horror went away in the 30s, in the late 30s. Then it came back in the 40s with World War II, where we're fighting all these European Gothic monsters like Dracula and Frankenstein.
Mm.
And then the war ends and horror goes away for 5 years. And it doesn't come back until the early 50s when you have atomic anxiety now. So now filmmakers are finding these new ways to tell these metaphors about these new fears.
Yeah, it's fascinating, really. I mean, like, in the immediate post-war years, probably, you know, with Italian neorealism and even in the United States with, like, The Best Years of Our Lives and movies like that, I think there was an attempt to confront those social and political issues a little bit more directly. But to your point, then with, like, you know, the Cold War and the threat of nuclear annihilation, I think horror kind of became the perfect allegory to present those themes and those fears.
Yeah. They got done to death, but the good ones... They're so good.
Yeah, absolutely. And still kind of timely for a lot of those themes, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, this is a great time to hit you with our sponsor break. Zach Linder, the Zach Pack, is powered by Coldwell Banker Realty. They are your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing, and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the show notes. I'm going to try to find a comment. You know, the downside of us going on a little break was... You know, we stopped beating the drum a little bit on listener comments. But folks, if you're out there, please, shout out to us and just give me a second. I'm going to try to find an old one. I'm going to dig into our archives.
All right.
Let's see here. I'm trying to find one that's also maybe a little relevant. Ooh, the Valley of Gwangi. We got a couple of comments on that.
Nice.
Let's see here. Oh, this is weird. Oh, no, it's not. Yes, it is. So Michelle Abela, 1 year ago, commented on our YouTube video for the Valley of Gwangi. Michelle says, this video is great like dynamite. And then used a dynamite emoji. It looks like 1,000 times. I can't count that many.
Whoa.
Yeah. Thanks, so. Michelle. She felt very strongly about us, maybe Gwangi. I don't know.
Yeah, and maybe like you, she's a diehard fan of the Valley of Gwangi. I would like to believe it's us, but I think it's more the movie. That's my guess.
Maybe. Hey, don't sell yourself short.
Thanks either way, Michelle. That's very nice.
Well, Michelle, you have two fans here. We'd love to hear from you again if you happen to be... listening.
Yeah. I hope our other videos are dynamite too.
Dynamation.
Hey. Nice. It all comes together.
I just love this movie. Okay. Now we're going to turn it over to Peter Lorre.
Welcome to Poverty Row Studios. On the other side of Hollywood, where the stars were dimmer and the red carpets dripped with blood. Together, we will watch the best of the worst, movies known for their limited budgets, outlandish concepts, and questionable performances, but with enough ghosts, zombies, ape men, and devil bats to keep you up at night. This is the Poverty Row Picture Show, and I dare you to sleep through these nightmares. Hello, listeners, and thank you for joining me in this new segment as we scrape the bottom of the Hollywood barrel. What we find may be questionable, but keep an open mind. Some of our favorite monsters live in the quagmire of our psyches. If I may introduce myself, I am Peter Lorre. You may know me from such films as The Beast with Five Fingers and Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. This week on the Poverty Row Picture Show, that is right, of course. Listeners, allow me to introduce my assistant. No, Pierre, you are not a co-host. I don't care what imaginations you harbor in that insignificant brain of yours. My apologies, listeners. This is Pierre, my little rodent friend and one-time would-be assassin. It is a tale of horror and bloodshed that I will share as we get to know each other a little better throughout the season. Now, as I was saying, this week on the Poverty Row Picture Show, I am discussing the 1940 horror comedy Boys of the City from Monogram Pictures. This dreadful affair stars the lovably dim-witted gang of orphans known as the East End Kids. They made dozens of screwball pictures throughout Hollywood's golden age. Boys of the City finds the rascals solving a ghostly murder mystery in a mansion in the country. Hilarity ensues when gangsters arrive with their own schemes and desires for fame and desires for riches. Now, the film is directed by Joseph H. Lewis, a director of later distinction, and despite the overall technical deficiencies, the ensemble offers enough charm for what it is worth. However, where I cannot in good faith recommend this movie is in its portrayal of the one black character of the gang, played by Sunshine Sammy Morrison. Oh, my friends, fellow listeners, there are some regrettable moments of racial caricature that are scarier than any of the ghostly goings-on. I can only hope that future East End Kid installments are more sensitive in this manner. But only time will tell! No, Pierre, you should not laugh at any of this. This was a terrible moment in the film. That, what you are referencing, don't ever do that again in my presence, please. What is the matter with you? Go do whatever it is that the little podcasting rats do. Anyways, next time on the Poverty Row Picture Show, we serve up our first mad scientist feature, a Boris Karloff movie known as The Ape. It promises to be some serious monkey business. You'll simply go bananas over this tale of crazed madness and monkeying around.
Ladies and gentlemen, what you are about to see has never been seen before by human eyes.
There's a big lizard back there, and he's heading this way. Now get aboard!
You can talk about themes a little bit.
Yeah, we can talk about themes.
Okay. I didn't find much. I mean, I think those are just kind of like the obligatory themes.
Although, yeah, so... You know, as we already talked about, it's very much about the fears of atomic bomb testing. That is the force that awakens the Retosaurus in this movie, the beast, if you will. But, you know, I feel like this movie's attitude towards nuclear weaponry and just like nuclear science in general is a little bit ambivalent. Like, it's kind of a negative force, but also the way that they kill the monster is by shooting a radioactive isotope into its throat, into like a throat wound, basically. Which is amazing. That scene is so awesome. I'm sure we'll talk more about that too. But and even like early on when they're doing, you know, the military is doing their atomic bomb testing, and some of the dialogue is like this wondrous new world of advancement and progression. Mm-hmm. And there's like a little bit of like there's an ominous tone to it, sort of. But there's also like just this sense of like, look at what human beings can do. Isn't this great? And then, of course, they have to contend with this large dinosaur thing. But I just think it's kind of interesting, you know, like later movies, in particular, a lot of the Godzilla movies are just like very anti-nuclear weaponry, of course, and that's understandable. But this movie seems to be a little bit more ambivalent about it.
Yeah. There's a quote that stood out to me early in the beginning when they're still in the Arctic. And the character's name is George Ritchie. Maybe he's the one who gets crushed under the ice, but he's referring to they're testing an atomic bomb. And he says, quote, "You know, every time one of these things goes off, I feel as if I was helping to write the first chapter of a new Genesis."
I remember that line. And I think another character right afterwards says, "Hopefully it's not the last chapter of the old one." Yeah, like that's a great, you know, that's the contradiction there in a nutshell, you know?
Yeah, that was a line that stood out to me, because the rest of the movie, I think, is a little ho-hum in its script and its themes.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting to think about the Redisaurus as this living weapon of war, because it destroys New York. It was born of the atomic bomb, or it was awakened by it. And it's impervious to bullets. I mean, they're shooting everything they have at it. And then its blood turns out to be poisonous. And I read that as chemical warfare at that point. And I just thought that was a really interesting angle thematically. Like, you're the American army and you're up against something that's like a Swiss army knife of weapons. And you put this in the context of the Cold War. And I think that allegory is frightening to American viewers at the time. Like, what if our army isn't the best? What if our army can't win? We're led to believe it will.
Right. I think you're totally right about that. And I, you know, eventually the American military and like science does save the day, but there's certainly a question, you know, with the blood that seems to spread this virus at like a very alarming rate. That's a really interesting subplot. And like, the movie doesn't really do a lot with it, unfortunately, but I do think it's a powerful allegory or symbol of just like the spread of nuclear radiation. Like, it's kind of unstoppable in a way, you know?
Oh yeah. I hadn't thought about that.
It's a kind of an all purpose allegory in a way, or metaphor.
Yeah. Better word for you it. Know, so the giant behemoth, that other Eugene Laurier movie, I just remembered that the dinosaur in that, it's irradiated, and the effects of it moving through villages is more apparent than it usually is in a movie, where the effects of the excess radioactivity is never really shown or dealt with. But in the giant behemoth, it is like plants die. Pets fall ill. Like, that's a main plot point in that movie.
That sounds great. It sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it's like the dinosaur is actually not the real threat. It's the radiation. It's spreading through the land.
Oh man, we got to bring that movie to the podcast. Sounds really good. And
yeah.
I now consider myself a Eugene or Eugene Laurier fan. So let's watch more of his stuff.
Me too. The Colossus of New York, I've never seen. Never heard of it. I got to do my homework.
And me too. Let's add it to the list. But yeah, I mean, like, you know, I guess back to the subject of like the theme about fear around atomic testing and nuclear weaponry in this movie. I think like it was like so influential. Like, this was one of the first ones to really like bring that theme into a monster movie that maybe it seems like somewhat stale now in retrospect, but you know, it's kind of cool to think about in 1953. I mean, it was just, you know, what, 8 years after the bombings on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that's like a major plot point in this movie. So that's kind of audacious in retrospect.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I like what you said, that in hindsight, it may seem a little stale, because I think that's kind of like where I think that's why this movie can feel a little underrated at times. Like, people know King Kong and Godzilla. You mentioned The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. If you're not a fan of these movies, you might have never heard of it. I think that's a shame, but I think there's maybe a reason for that. Just, you know, when you take everything else that came after it, I think it can get lost in the mix a little bit.
Totally. I would agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry. There's one other theme I was going to bring up. And if you wanted to move on or whatever, that's okay. But so I was reading some reviews online of this movie, and I happened to find one that's like 10 years old, and it's from somebody's blog. I had never heard of it before. The review is by somebody named Dawn Keeley, and I guess I don't know what their pronouns are, but they make the point in the review that like it could function also as an allegory for like fear of desegregation in American life at the time. Oh. And the review makes the point that like all of the characters in the movie are white except for the Beast, which is visibly obviously very dark. And, you know, like that argument didn't totally convince me. I was like, well, the majority of characters in American movies at this time, unfortunately, are white. And, you know, I think they were just trying to make the Beast, you know, look like a dinosaur, basically. But then Dawn Keeley in this review makes the point that when Professor Nesbitt and Lee Van Cleef put on the radioactive hazmat gear at the end,
yes,
they're white hoods. They look like Ku Klux Klan members. And
oh, my God.
I don't know if that's intentional. I kind of doubt it is, but it doesn't really matter. Like, I think it is a really interesting connection. And even if this movie isn't like an intentional commentary on like desegregation, it's like an interesting theme to bring into it. And maybe some of those racial tensions, just in terms of the visual symbolism, is still kind of there a little bit, you know?
Dude, when I thought the same thing when they put on those hazmat suits, because one looks like a hazmat suit, but the other one, the headpiece, it looks like a white bag. Like you would see like Django Unchained, like they put the bags on their heads. And I was startled. I was like, what? And it's intended or not. I don't think it was intended.
Right. I agree.
But regardless, as a resident of the United States of America, in tune with our history, that did catch my eye.
Yeah, me too. I mean, you know, like you said, as soon as they put the hoods on, it's like, ooh, that is not a good look, you know, like, you know, if you're aware of American history. So, it's a fascinating insight. When I read that in that review, I was like, wow, the thought processes are going off, you know?
Wow. Interesting.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Intentionality maybe in the end doesn't matter all that much. It's still a very powerful visual symbol, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah.
Could you share that link? I'd like to read that myself.
Yeah, for sure. Yep.
Cool.
I'll do so after the episode.
Well, I'm happy to go into our personal breakdowns here.
Totally. Yeah.
Okay. What'd you like about this movie?
Well, I'll start with some of the form aesthetic stuff. I'll like include that in my breakdown here. You know, I mean, like, again, the Ray Harryhausen special effects are really fantastic. They're so well done. I think they're like as convincing as any stop motion animation had ever been up until this point of movie history. And in particular, I just kind of want to call out a couple things, I guess. You know, we talked about the Dynamation before, and I think that's why the interrelation of like background and foreground scenes seems very convincing to me in this movie. Like, usually, like in King Kong, you can tell that like the stop motion stuff is in the background and like the characters, the human actors, are just like interacting with the screen. But in this movie, I think it really does feel like the monster is like 20 feet away from them. You know, it's a very convincing effect. Shout out to Ray Harryhausen on that. And I think also just like he's almost like an actor in a way in this movie, Ray Harryhausen, because he's trying to think of like what the Beast would do, the way it would move, the way it would respond to certain things. Like there's one moment towards the end where he's shot. I think he's shot by a bazooka, not just by like normal bullets. And he like responds sort of like an angry cat would do, like it's hissing or something, you know? And there's another moment where the Beast like steps on a car and then like drags it along with him for a little bit, which I think is just a level of detail that many effects animators would not have done up until that time or even afterwards. So there's more that I like about this movie, but I'm just going to leave it at that. It's, I think, the best stop-motion effects ever up until that point of cinema history.
And it's see, these are things I didn't pick. I didn't really appreciate when I first watched this a number of years ago, because I completely agree. Now that I've seen even other Harryhausen movies, his work in this takes the cake for me. It's so meticulously refined, and that level of dedication from him is inspiring. But there are several set pieces in this movie of action that, coupled with the cinematography, I think is so beautiful. The black and white in this movie is crisp, and yeah, you know, a good black and white cinematographer knows how to work with those shades. There's the beginning, everything in the Arctic. Very impressed with that set design. When the Redosaurus attacks those fishermen, I was very impressed. There's a shot of the beast in the ocean, like playing with the boat, like he's in a bathtub. Very impressive. The lighthouse, underwater, the Cecil Kellaway character goes down in a diving bell, and he's amongst this canyon and these giant cliffs. And the light is silhouette. It's like sparkling through the water. Like, the underwater effects were really good in this movie. And the ending at the amusement park with the inferno. Oz is like, man, fire always looks good in black and white. And this is why.
Absolutely. Yeah. We haven't really talked about that ending too much, but, you know, they ride a roller coaster to like get up to a higher level to like shoot the isotope into the monster. And I mean, you know, you have like a marksman, you have a roller coaster, you have a big dinosaur. How can you go wrong? It's so it's amazing.
It's so good. And the monster's crying and screaming. It's death throes. I would love to see this movie on a big screen.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking watching it.
Oh, man. Maybe somebody will play it at some point. We got to go if they do. That sounds so fun.
Yeah.
I think you make a really good point that, you know, it is Harryhausen's stop motion work, but it's also the cinematography and the set design and so many other things that come together to make it look as great as it does.
Yeah. And it was a cheapy independent movie.
So impressive. Yeah.
Yeah. Like Godzilla Minus One. Anything, you can do good work. You can rise above what you're given with the right people on board.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you have that creativity and that energy and that desire, it's totally doable. That reminds me of a Roger Ebert quote that I read it secondhand. I don't actually know what review it's from of his, but I read it in a different review of The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. But Ebert's quote basically says, you know, stop motion effects work looks fake but feels real, and CGI looks real but feels fake. And I couldn't agree more. I love that. Like, it's absolutely true, in my opinion.
Interesting. Wow, cool. Yeah, I like that. What didn't work for you?
Well, I think, as often happens in kaiju movies, the human characters are not very interesting. I think that's especially true in this case. You know, we have the professor, then you have another professor, then you have the love interest, then you have like maybe two or three like military guys who are just like square jawed and no nonsense and like obviously don't believe in these stories about a giant dinosaur. So like whenever the beast is not on screen, the movie does drag a little bit. None of the human characters are really that substantial.
Yeah.
And you know, we talked about like the blood with a virus in it and how the movie doesn't really like do anything with that idea. That was another shortcoming, I thought. And even though I love that this movie is only 80 minutes long, I think it could have been like 85 to 90 to like draw out some of those themes a little bit.
Couldn't agree more. I think the blood wrinkle in this as a conflict in this story, you might as well not have it in there because it's such a tease. It's such a good like twist. But
yeah,
the movie doesn't do anything with it because it's only 80 minutes. I would have loved to have seen them now like, okay, how do we figure out this problem before we figure out how to defeat the actual monster?
Yeah.
Such a, like the remake, if there's a remake of this, they have to go into that more.
Totally. Yeah. Like maybe if they had introduced that theme earlier, if like one of the first times, like, you know, the beast bleeds for some reason and they figure it out like relatively early on that that's an issue, that could maybe work. But
right.
Yeah, it's a little bit pointless here, even though it's a cool idea.
Yeah. Yeah, the human characters, they're bland. There's nothing there. But Nesbitt especially I don't want, I'm not picking on the actor, but why was he cast? Like, I just feel like he is such a template, like a cookie cutter white guy.
Yeah.
I'm like, give me a Lee Van Cleef in this role. Give me Cary Grant. Like, I don't know, like someone more interesting than Mr. White Bread here, because he doesn't really do anything, and he's not, I don't know. He's just watching paint dry.
Right. Yeah. No, fully agree. I mean, he's tall and he has great hair, and that was probably the reason he was cast. I feel kind of bad saying this, but he also has kind of a French accent because he's a Swiss actor.
Yeah.
And that's fine, but it doesn't totally make sense for an American professor to, you know, it just is not very convincing, you know?
I thought the same thing. I just wanted, like, Kenneth Toby. He plays the supporting colonel. I was like, I would make him the lead.
Yeah. Nick Adams, maybe, you know?
Nick Adams, come on.
Yeah. Like, there were probably many better choices than Paul Christian or, yeah. I'm with you on that.
I mean, now that we're talking about it, there's a lot of, like, campy, silly things in this movie. But, like, at the end, when the Redosaurus is rampaging through the city, at one point, the army's like, we don't know where it is. I'm like, how? Why?
Yeah. Listen to, like, huge thunderous footsteps and you'll probably be able to find it, you know?
Follow the screams. It's New York City.
That too, yeah. The burning buildings, the smoke rising into the air. Probably a lot of giveaways.
Who took their eyes off the...
Yeah. It's not very stealthy. It shouldn't be that hard. Yeah, I mean, in general, the army... I guess to your point, like, the army does seem kind of inept in this movie. And there, my favorite death in the movie is the poor police officer who just has this tiny pistol and he's like shooting at the monster and it of course does nothing at all. And then the beast, like, you know, like bites him right at his midsection. I was actually wondering if that scene in Jurassic Park was kind of like an homage to that, you know, because it's very, very similar. Like the beast just, like, picks up that guy and just like devours him. It's like, these police officers have to be trained better. Your little pistol is not going to do anything against this thing.
Poor guy. He thought he was going to die a hero. And it's like, you didn't need to.
No.
You're not going to get the parade. I'm sorry.
He'll get a different kind of parade after he's gone.
At the end, it's Nesbitt, of course. And whoever else, they have to climb down the roller coaster because now it's on fire. And I get it. You have to climb down a burning roller coaster fairly slow. You don't want to miss your footing.
Yeah.
But once they hit the ground, they just saunter back over to like the people. But this giant monster is screaming to death. There's an inferno behind you and they're just like, take 10, everybody. Okay. Is that a wrap? Can we go home now? I'm like, guys, you got to give me some urgency. Why are you so calm right now?
I know exactly what you mean. I laughed at that too. Those two guys like pat each other on the back and they give them, like, one of them gives a look like, oof, thank God that's over with. And it's like, not appropriate for the situation.
I need to see the fear in your eyes that you just survived death. Like, come on.
Yeah. And there's an inferno right behind you.
No sense of heat. Like, they're not acting with what, you know, should be behind them.
Yeah. I thought that was amusing. Yeah. And then the movie ends like 10 seconds later. It's a very, very abrupt ending.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. My other last critique is that I mentioned it earlier. I just wanted, well, I'll put this in my final summation, actually. So let's rate this movie.
Okay. Can I mention one campy thing first?
Yeah.
For me, it would be the scene that you mentioned where Dr. Elson, I think his name is, goes underground into like that big underwater trench. And it is a good scene and it looks really beautiful. It's not very realistic looking, but again, I don't really care about that too much. But then I think the thing that's funny is like, they're supposed to look out the windows of this thing and see like a shark and an octopus fighting each other. Yeah. But like the perspective makes no sense. And clearly it's just like lifted from a scientific film. And like it, they would not be able to like see that from like where they are in their little diving bell or whatever.
Uh-huh.
So I thought that was amusing. And then another thing I thought was funny about that scene is that the doctor just keeps on talking like pretty much to himself, even though there's another guy in the diving bell, like a military assistant or whatever. And the doctor is like, saying like he's blathering on about like untold tomorrows and like future mysteries and oh I should have taken that Dramamine and like all this stuff, and the other guy doesn't say anything at all, and it just seemed really funny to me. Like I expected that other military guy to be like, you know, we can just ride down in silence, you don't have to say anything, man. Oh, like that entire scene was really funny, I thought.
And then the Retosaurus, it's almost like the doctor or the scientist is just blabbering while the Retosaurus is swimming up to the window. It's like a point of POV shot, and that's it, and he's eaten.
yeah you're right, and weirdly I kind of forgot that's how that scene ends, but
yeah
he probably should have been paying more attention.
Yeah, it's like he was caught off guard because he was lost in his own thought process. I shouldn't have had that burger for lunch. Oh.
Right. Yeah, maybe focus on the task at hand and don't just keep on talking for no reason.
Very funny.
Yeah. That scene is great.
Well, feel free to give us your legendary.
Oh, yeah. Spiel. Sorry, I'm dropping the ball. All right. As usual on Camp Kaiju, we have four different ratings. Number one, it's a timeless classic and definitely stands the test of time. Number two, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great. It stands the test of time. Number three, it may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. And our lowest rating, it's not worth revisiting. It definitely does not stand the test of time.
Okay. You go first. I'll end it since it was my pick.
Okay, that sounds good. It's between two ratings for me, but I think I have to give this our highest rating. It's a timeless classic, definitely stands the test of time. I would, you know, put a little caveat on there. There are some boring stretches and the humans are not very interesting. But, I mean, it was just so influential. It looks amazing. Maybe some of the best stop motion monster effects of all time. Even with its flaws, I think you have to say it's a timeless classic.
Oh, I love that. Truly. I truly do. And I'm also torn. I'm going to go with our second to lowest rating.
Whoa.
It definitely stands the test of time. Well, whatever our ratings are, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
We're, you know, the points don't matter and we're all winners. But it is a classic of the genre. It is a keystone of the genre. I think it's a must watch. And I think the best part is that this movie does hold up, actually. It's not a stale, you know, old, dusty old book that you bring out. Like, this movie is alive. It crackles. The visual effects are incredible. I mean, yeah, you're never whatever. I love them.
Yeah.
I just, you know, if we're saying if this movie wants to be King Kong and Godzilla, I do think it falls a touch short in the pathos department. I would have loved the monster to have been humanized a little bit more. Maybe it's looking for its lost love. I don't know. Maybe we go back to Bradbury's original story. But regardless, it's a must watch.
Yeah, I don't disagree with any of that. I think you're totally right. It's one of those movies where I'm like, it has some problems, and yet I love it. You know, like I liked it even more than I expected to. So it's great. So it's a fun watch. And even some of the like unintentionally funny stuff is still just really entertaining.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a shame that more people don't talk about this. Maybe they do. But like, I hadn't seen it till a few years ago. You know, I've seen them. I've seen Tarantula. I've seen all these other 50s atomic monster movies, but I hadn't seen this one. And I wonder if it gets lost in the genre it created.
I think you're exactly right about that. Yeah. And I, you know, like Godzilla is probably my favorite monster movie of all time. So like the movie that it influenced is better for sure. Like there, to me, there's no doubt about that. But like you said, this still holds up. It's not just an influence. It still is like a great movie in its own terms, I think.
Yeah. All right. Ray Harryhausen. So good to dip back into that. Well, we'll have to do it again. I'm really interested. I really love his fantasy movies, like The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. I want to watch Clash of the Titans. That's on my list.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
So yeah, maybe once a year we bring Harryhausen back.
Yeah, or more. But in any case, yeah, we definitely have to bring the Harryhausen back. Yeah.
Yeah. It'll happen. Yeah. The Harryhausen.
Which is a great name for a horror movie in itself. I don't know what the plot would be, but now my wheels are spinning.
All right. Well, thank you all for listening. Please rate and review wherever you listen. You could share this podcast with a friend. That's always cool. Bring in a trivia. Subscribe to the website. Oh, that's what I want to say. Folks, follow CampKaijuPodcast.com, but follow the website. And you can get email updates right into your inbox. Patreon, the same deal, of course. Matt, you have a Substack, too, where you review movies.
I do.
I'm happy to include a link to that in the show notes.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, yeah. Anyways, send us listener comments. That's the lifeblood that keeps our meeting mailbox going. CampKaiju@gmail.com, Instagram, all those links in the show notes. Or, hey, leave us a voicemail at 612-470-2612 telling us about what you thought about The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Check out our website. And Camp Kaiju is recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Meanie's Mailbox. Music by Ben Cook Feltz. Thanks, friends. And until next time, stay campy. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for invested clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the show notes.
There he is. It's unbelievable. He's tremendous. I can only see part of him. The leg and the shoulder. But he's enormous.
He found it. Shall we pull you up?
No. Put Lee on.
He wants to talk to you.
Yes, doctor?
Lee, there's no mistake about it. It's a paleolithic survival. Exactly as we pictured it, except that the dorsal is singular, not bilateral. Clavicle suspension appears to be cantilevered. But the most astonishing thing about it is that...
You know, we can just ride down in silence. You don't have to say anything, man.